Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Rick Bragg, whose new book is Where I Come From, Stories from the Deep South. Bragg is one of our great Southern storytellers. He began with journalism, of course, and then won our hearts with tales of his family. Books like All Over But the Shoutin', The Prince of Frogtown, and my favorite, The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table. He took a few detours in biography for I Am a Soldier Too, the Jessica Lynch story, the authorized biography of the American POW, and then Jerry Lee Lewis, his own story, a biography of the rock and roll legend. Then we got My Southern Journey in 2018, and now we have Where I Come From, Stories from the Deep South, a collection of writings from the past 5 years in such publications as Southern Living and Garden and Gun. Perhaps only Rick Bragg could write such a cheering and companionable book for housebound folks in these strange days. Rick Bragg, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you. Your radio voice is very professional.
Thank you. I've only been doing this for 10 years, man.
Well, you know.
It worked.
Another 10 or 15 years, you're going to have it down.
I'm keep open. I'm so glad to hear your voice. And I have to ask, how's your mama? Everybody wants to know.
Well, she is obstinate and does more or less exactly what she wants to do. True story. She came in limping the other day, and I said, "What'd you do?" And she said, "Well, you know, your dog likes to play with an empty milk jug, but he can't get his teeth on it right if I don't stomp it first." And I was stomping him a milk jug, and I turned my ankle. And I just kind of sat down and thought, where else in the world would that happen? Your mama injured herself stomping a milk jug.
For the dog.
For the dog.
Oh, so you've been quarantining together.
We have. We both have to be really careful, you know, like a lot of people.
Have you gained a lot of weight with her cooking?
I have gained, yeah. It's impossible not to on a steady diet of biscuits and pork fat. I mean, I'm to the point now where I think that if I eat a piece of fried chicken, that is somehow a real sacrifice on my part.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, we're at the end of a long driveway, about a third of a mile, and about the only people that come to see us are the UPS man and the FedEx. It's quiet.
I like to think of both of you safe and sound, and I think of your mama every time I see that book in my kitchen. The last time I talked to you, I just went off. I closed the book and I hung up the phone and I went off and I baked my son a pie. I mean, she's very inspiring that way. So are you.
Well, funny thing about writing any kind of food memoir, if you don't cook, I'm not a cook, is it's kind of like writing about brain surgery or rocket science. You're kind of fumbling around in the dark. And one interviewer asked me, "What are you hoping for with this book? Are you hoping that to spread your mother's magic throughout the world?" And I said, "No, I'm just kind of hoping that we don't send anybody to the emergency room."
always hope that. Yeah. Now, you were actually finishing up this book while you were self-isolating. So what was it like to be there with her alone looking at your work? I mean, so much of this is from pretty much the past 5 years.
Yeah, it's a kind of a true compilation this time.
So what does that feel like to look at what you've written and have another round with it?
Well, it convinces you that no matter how much you might pretend not to be a nerd throughout your younger life, there's always going to be a point where you and your nerdness are going to be trapped together. And I'd find myself reading a line and say, dang, that's pretty good. Or, I'd read a line and I'd go, yeah, I think I used that two or three times in my lifetime. and to spend all that time with, again, lines that you've already written years ago sometimes, you can let it almost drives you crazy because, you can't do anything about it. A lot of the stories were about aunts and uncles and kinfolk who have since passed. So it was truly kind of sitting there with your ghost. My mother is now the only remaining sibling of a great family of, blue-collar working people from the foothills of the Appalachians, whiskey makers and farmers and carpenters and, knife fighters and just fun people. They're all gone now. And four of them left either during the pandemic or just before. And she just looked at me one day, and said, well, I'm all that's left. And to sit down there, my office at the farmhouse, her farm, it's in the middle of 40 acres of kind of very rugged mountain pasture. But my little office is in the basement. So I am the 60-year-old man living in his mother's basement.
Oh, no.
I'm still going to the co-op to buy hog feed, still lugging horse feed around. And I can tell you, 50 pounds seemed to be a lot lighter when I was younger doing this. But to sit there in that hole in the ground and read about people when they were alive.
Yeah.
And not like my other books where I was writing often about people that were long gone. Some people I had never met. I had to create through the stories of people still living. But, I'm writing about people who passed while the book was in production. It kind of broke my heart. But it also reminded me, I know it's a cliche by now, but I don't believe much in moral victories, and I don't really believe you can keep someone alive. If you think you can keep someone alive in a story, then you never got to sit with them in life. But you can keep a vestige, a ghost. You can keep it close.
You can keep a lot of love alive, I think.
I think you're absolutely right.
But there are other people you write about that you miss a lot, too. People like Pat Conroy and Harper Lee, who meant a lot to you.
I was one of those writers that wouldn't approach Harper Lee because I didn't want to be one more writer sitting on her doorstep waiting to touch the hem of her garment. And even though that book meant the world to me, even though that book was one of the first times in my life that I kind of understood the wider world around me down here. But I never would do that. And then I finally got a chance to meet her and went to see her in a little nursing home, retirement center, I guess. And she was just, this little woman sitting on the edge of her bed. The room was real hot. And she was talking to Wayne Flint, the great historian. And he and his wife got up, walked away, and Harper Lee leaned in real close to me and said, "There go the only two people from Auburn I ever liked."
That's a moment. That's a moment.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But it's funny the literary starstruck, thing. It's funny to feel that. Everybody feels it sooner or later, don't you think?
I was at one of those big book festivals, with a lot of authors and a big crowd of people. And it was one of those kind of orchestrated chaos. There were authors everywhere, and there was a big crowd in the middle. I was running late. This was back when I was young enough to actually move in a hurry. and I was just busting it through the crowd to get to my table to sign books. And I accidentally knocked over a display for Richard Ford.
No. Oh, dear.
And he just looked up at me. I can't repeat the words he used on any kind of public forum. Yeah, there are moments.
That's a moment I wish I'd seen, too.
There are moments. He was kidding. At least I hope he was.
Probably.
I was at the Alabama Book Festival with Conroy, and I had just finished a line of the folks. And, you know, it was in Montgomery, Alabama, so it was kind of home field advantage.
Of course.
For me, and I had just signed the last book. And I look over, and Pat Conroy has got a line extending to Wetumpka.
Yep.
You know, maybe Prattville. And he just looked over at me, and without even looking up, said, "Bragg, you can have half of mine if you need them."
And
so, yeah.
A little lesson in humility.
In this business, as you know, you get a lesson in humility about every 13 minutes.
Welcome back to more great Southern storytelling from Rick Bragg, whose new book is Where I Come From. So listen, now you devote, as you always do, which I love, so much literary real estate to New Orleans in this collection. And it was such a pleasure to read those again, starting with the essay, The Mean Season, which we're just getting out of a little bit. It's like a cool day here today. This city's been a steady muse for you. It's been home. It's just meant so many things to you over time, a long time.
Well, you know, I always heard that old cliche about New Orleans is, you know, you never really get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
You can move away. I mean, you can move to Montana. You can move to Bangladesh, but you'll never really get away from it. And in some ways, and I don't claim to know it or understand it, and I certainly don't know it as it metamorphosizes, as it goes into it changes. But then there are those things that never change. So in some ways, my New Orleans is frozen in a time warp, I guess. But that's all right, because you can still go there and reach out and touch it. I mean, I wish you could still go out and touch Uglitch's restaurant. You know, I wish, you know, Miss Peggy Dunbar and them were still there at that restaurant. I go to New Orleans, and it's like I enter back into that time warp some way. And New Orleans, just, you can say it's different. But the fact is, you know, I really would wake up at my house there at the corner of Joseph and Annunciation, and I would fling the quilt back, and my feet would touch that pine floor, and, you know, 100-year-old pine floor or older, and know that there's nothing between those pine planks and the dirt. You know, I call it crawfish dirt, that old powdery dirt uptown. And the minute my feet touched that floor, I knew I was going to get away with something. I knew that, you know, not murder, or, you know, I wasn't going to rob a bank there in the quarter and shoot my way out, but I was going to get away with something.
Just some misbehavior.
even if that was just mild misbehavior, or just waking up to, you know, a little bit of an excess that just made life so much better. You know, maybe that was just a pork chop po' boy from
right.
Guys,
yep,
on magazine, or maybe it's just a little corner grocery store that sells bread pudding in a plastic tub, and you take it home and you eat a third of it cold sitting on the porch. Or just, you know, going to the Rockin' Bowl and hearing Rosie LeDay play her accordion. Or
and in the old days when you could feel the floor shake.
Absolutely.
You know.
And it did shake. You know, again, I'm not pretending that I had this, like, great, exciting life. For me, a great late afternoon was to go get a cup of coffee and walk up to the riverfront and sit down on one of those benches and watch a freighters go by.
Yeah.
How do you not love sitting there on that highway and seeing those freighters as long as a football field or more glide down that river and try to make that turn there?
Good life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you ever do leave it. And I had been to New Orleans in the summer not long ago, and I always kind of felt sorry for the mule.
Yeah.
Because I remember the mule moving so laboriously, if that's a word, up the street, and listening to that history that the carriage drivers would spout. But it was kind of more drunk, you know, in the hot weather. And I would go sometimes because it was really hot weather.
I know. When you write about the hurricane season, that hot, hot month, oh, you can feel it.
Yeah.
I swear. Oh.
If you're going to drink a Barq's root beer in a bottle, and of course this is fish in a barrel, but if you're going to get a po' boy and get a Barq's in a bottle, it's colder in August than it is in May.
Now, I remember that you used to have, and there was this famous picture of this, you used to have this Everlast punching bag on the back porch of your house in New Orleans. Do you still hit a bag?
Yeah.
Do you still do that?
No, mostly I just, like most writers, I just do it all inside my mind. Yeah, I beat the hell out of that punching bag.
You did.
You know, like a lot of people in New Orleans, I didn't really have a backyard. You know, I had a little courtyard out back and had a big old bougainvillea in it that birds would nest in. And three or four freezes took that thing down. It always come back. But I would go out, and usually in New Orleans, your frustrations are not so much taken out as medicated, you know, with a really good supper or on some balcony somewhere. But yeah, I would beat on that thing and tell myself that. And it's just a lot more fun beating on a punching bag than it is walking a mile.
No kidding. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Rick Bragg, whose new book is Where I Come From, Stories from the Deep South. You know what I've forgotten about? I forgot about the pleasure of going for a ride on Sunday afternoon and that whole thing about driving with your elbow out the window.
Yeah.
You know, those are some sweet, sweet moments.
A magazine editor asked me once what it was that kept people coming back to these snatches and pieces of memory. And I told him that you cannot underestimate the power of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can be an evil force. You know, sometimes people want things to be like they used to be in a bad way, and they cling to it, and they will not see any kind of change as good. But then there are folks who cling to it in a good way, and who they just like to remember, not when, you know, things just made some kind of sense to them, but they just like to remember a time when the family was bigger, you know?
Yeah.
A family reunion was 50, 100 people strong when you would pop the top off Tupperware and there would be, you know, fried chicken sweating on a warm towel. And you know, popping the top off of a box of chicken from the Winn-Dixie is not the same. I think the power of nostalgia, of just remembering, you just can't underestimate how important it is in people's lives. And it's why people will spend half an afternoon with a photo album.
Yeah, true.
You know, and I used to write much harder stuff and, you know, miserably frightening, bad, dangerous sometimes stuff, you know, about poverty and violence. And I kind of reached a point in my life where what the people who pay you to write and who give you an opportunity to write, what they seem to want mostly is just remembering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not going out digging up something, but just remembering. And there is a point in your life where you just have to say, well, maybe that's the best place for me. I knew an old newspaper editor who had taken over. He was the curator of a, and that's a fancy word,
mm-hmm.
but the curator of a fellowship program where he had these writers and editors come in, and he kind of ran the program. And he told me once, I asked him, I said, don't you want to just get out there and roll your sleeves up and mix it up with City Hall, you know, or Washington? And he looked at me and he said, this is the best place for me.
Wow.
You know, this is the best place for me. And what he meant was just taking a step back and realizing that what he was doing had some good. And I think that every time I do a book signing and someone walks up and says, you stole my story, all they're saying is, I get it. And sometimes there's a great sadness in that. You know, if you're writing about children who passed away during the Depression because they couldn't get a doctor, that happened to my mama's family.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, someone your mama's age walks up and starts telling you the story of a sister, you know, or a brother. And I don't think I've made a living writing because I'm doing a great job talking about my people. I think I made a living writing because I've written little pieces and glimmers of other people's stories. They kind of cleave to that. And I guess that's the best of it at this point in my life.
And that's why it's such a perfect book for this moment, because I think so many people are looking back, taking stock. And I think those essays you wrote about Halloween and Christmas are really going to ring true this year for a lot of people, those rich memories, as we wonder, you know, what's even possible in what lies ahead. So it's a very cheering book in a way. I mean, you know,
the bottom line is that most of it is at least a lame and feeble attempt to be funny.
It is funny.
You know, writing about Halloween, how can you not have fun writing about Halloween?
And, yep.
You know, you've seen the jokes about, you know, making a mummy's costume out of toilet paper. We did that.
I did that.
You know? Yeah, we did that. And, you know, and then there was this year where my big brother had got all serious, and he said, "I ain't gonna go out trick or treating. I'm a grown man, you know." And he was like 11. You know, I wanted to be like him, so I said, "Well, I'm not gonna dress up for Halloween. You know, I'll tote a sack and I'll ask for candy, but you know, I'm not gonna." Dressed up, and I was a very manly 8-year-old, and that was a mistake because my mean girl cousin saw I didn't have a costume and they dressed me up like a doll.
Oh,
yeah. So I learned my lesson.
Wish there were pictures of that. Well, this is one of my favorite books I've read during this whole terrible time, so I thank you for it.
Well, all right, then.
We've been talking with the beloved by me and so many of you, storyteller Rick Bragg. His new book is Where I Come From, Stories from the Deep South. Rick, thank you as always so much.
Well, it's not a book if I don't talk to you.
So. Well, thank you very much. I'll take that to heart. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week.
Just a reminder, Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, continues this weekend in its new online incarnation. Check out wordsandmusic.org for a complete schedule. A few things to look forward to. Friday, November 20th at 3, the Podunk Review and Words and Music present the winners and runners-up of the 2020 Words and Music Writing Competition. Katie Devine, Constance Adler, Elizabeth Gross, Titus Chalk, Andy Young, and R. Tiara Malone. And Sunday, November 22nd at 12:30, don't miss an online performance of Tom Dent's great play, Ritual Murder. The closing day is billed as the Day of Dent and should be fantastic. Edward Ball discusses his book, Life of a Klansman, A Family History and White Supremacy, in a Zoom discussion with Michael Lomax, the president and CEO of the United Negro College Fund and former president of Dillard University. That's Monday, November 23rd at 6. Free, but go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com to register. Rick Bragg appears in a Zoom conversation with Terry Troncalli discussing Where I Come From, Stories from the Deep South. Tuesday, November 24th at 6. To register, go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com. Support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, and the Hillis Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.